Static. Welcome back to Memory Static, the podcast that finds the movies you watched when you were little, talks about them, and throws a party to watch them. And stay tuned to the end for a new original song based on the movie we are covering tonight. I'm your host, Bailey Moore, and I have with me longtime childhood friend, Melissa Miles. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited for you to be here. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a music teacher in the district that I grew up in. I'm married. I have 4 kids. So I have a very pretty busy life.
Do y'all watch movies together?
I watch more movies with the kids than I do with my husband, but my kids are big movie fans.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Now, when we grew up together in what was practically the same neighborhood, within walking distance, and we had a lot of sleepover parties, which included lots of ghost stories and lots of movies. And other than my sister and cousin, you are the first person that I've had on here where we've actually watched movies together when we were little.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. It's really fun. So tell us what movie we're going to be watching tonight.
We're going to be watching Dot and the Whale. I remember I told my mom, because I remembered it as a kid. I remembered watching it, but I asked my mom, because I couldn't remember anything about it, but like one specific scene. And I asked her, do you remember this movie with this little girl and there was a dolphin and a weird octopus? And she thought I was crazy. She did not believe me for the longest time. And I remember trying to find it on YouTube. I looked for it for years until I finally found it. I think I was in college when I found a clip of it. And I was like, I'm not crazy. It's real.
Isn't that amazing? It's such an extraordinary thing that we live in a time where something that we encountered as a child can be easily found through the internet.
Yeah, it's wild.
It's a very interesting phenomena that there are these windows of experiences. We watch these things as we're little and we perceive them in a certain way. And then they're like a time capsule and we rewatch them. And it's kind of like this strange thing where, like, especially if you haven't seen it since you were a kid, you can remember the impressions that you had, but then you're seeing it entirely differently.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited to see it as an adult and see if I have the same feelings as I did when I was a kid watching it. You know, it'll be interesting.
Do you remember where you watched it?
I watched it at home, you know.
Watched it at home.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember watching it more than once. It was one of my like go-to movies, but I guess my mom just never watched it with me and didn't believe me that it was real.
How funny.
Yeah.
And you haven't seen this at all as an adult?
I've seen little clips of it, the ones that I found on YouTube, but I haven't watched it from the start to the finish since I was a kid. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what I remember and what I don't.
Well, this is really exciting.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. And I'm going to make my husband watch it with me too. So.
Wonderful.
Yeah, exactly.
So to the best of your ability, can you give us a summary of what this movie is about?
Okay, so I know that there's a little girl and she's trying to help a whale that's stranded on the beach or something like that. And there's someone else who wants to exploit the whale's presence or something. I can't remember most of it, but I remember there's a dolphin that takes her through the ocean and it's like a mix of live action and animation and very odd and surreal. I remember it just being very odd as a kid.
You know what? That's actually a really good, you've got a pretty good memory for it because it's animated and live action, and it is kind of trippy, especially when she goes underwater.
Yes.
So did you go to the beach when you were a kid?
Not very much.
Do you have any memories of going to the beach, like any stories?
I remember being stung by a jellyfish once in the ocean. It like went all the way up my arm, and I remember that. I don't remember a whole lot of other memories, but that one stands out.
I don't think that you would forget something like that. That sounds horrible.
Yeah. My son likes to read books on dangerous animals and stuff like that. So he likes to quote me all these interesting facts about, you know, jellyfish and their stings. And I'm like, oh yeah, I've been stung by a jellyfish before. And he's like, really? Incredulous.
Is that a cat?
That's a cat. He's crying.
Oh.
Do you remember, I don't know if you ever read, because we went to the same school, so I'm sure we probably read the same book. It was a book about Island of the Blue Dolphins.
Island of the Blue Dolphins. I didn't actually read it, but I remember watching the movie when I was a kid.
Yeah, the cover of the book, I remember how it felt. Almost like suede. It was real smooth, like a dolphin. It's like the book feels like a dolphin, which was a really interesting realization. Yeah, that's what I found really interesting. Like, it felt like a dolphin, and it's a book about dolphins.
Yeah.
Which maybe was part of the idea behind making it feel that way.
Maybe, yeah. So what were your favorite animals when you were growing up?
Oh, I was into horses.
I remember.
You remember?
I remember.
Every square inch of my bedroom was covered in pictures of horses.
I remember the posters. At some point, you started working at a stable, right?
I did, yeah. For a summer between, I think, like 6th and 7th grade. Like, looking back on it now, especially as a mom, it's amazing that my mom ever let me do this. She would drop me off at like 9 in the morning, and I would stay at this stable with all these horses and a really grumpy old man that we didn't know. A porta potty, that was my restroom. And she would come pick me up at like 4 in the afternoon, and I'd be covered in dirt and all sorts of nasty stuff, but just the happiest. That was the happiest summer of my childhood, bar none. There's no comparison. It was the best.
That's a good mom move on her part.
Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, thinking about it as a mom, I'm like, I would be so nervous to let my kids do that. But I mean, it was the best, most freeing. I got to go ride a horse out in the paddock when we didn't have a trail ride coming. I would just go ride a horse for a couple of hours. No saddle, just go ride.
Not a saddle, just bareback?
Yeah.
Wow.
Just go out in the field and come back a couple hours later. And there were a couple of like stable dogs, and they knew the way to go back to the barn. And so did the horse. So once I was done riding, I would just let go of the reins, and the horse and the dogs would guide us back to the barn.
Melissa, that is so magical.
It was. I was like 12. Yeah. It was the best summer of my life.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know the extent of all of that. That is amazing.
Yeah, it really was. It was so cool.
Since we went to the same elementary school, do you remember the process of adopting whales?
I vaguely do. I remember the idea of like, I own a whale. Like, I didn't understand the process of like just sending money and caring for it in that way. But
yeah,
thought that I owned a whale and the whale was my pet.
Yeah, I had the same sense. I think we adopted it as a class. And then if they ever spotted the whale, they'd take a picture of it and send it.
Yeah. And
I thought like, oh my gosh, that's our class whale. I wonder if the whale knows.
Does he know my name?
Such an interesting thing. Did you ever make believe that you could talk to animals?
Oh, all the time. All the time. I totally thought that my dog growing up could understand me. I really thought she did. We had, you know, we were connected, soul connected.
Even at 12, did you like pretend that you had narratives with the horses?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had full conversations with them.
Amazing.
The only one that I could get on without a saddle, her name was Miss Star, and she was an ornery, cranky old mare. And I would have conversations with her on the little rides out in the paddock. And then she had a tell for when she was mad at me and she wanted to knock me off. She would lay her ears back and like duck her head and then go beeline for a tree that had a low hanging branch. So I understood her. Even though she couldn't actually talk, we had conversations.
That's so cute.
Yeah, it was fun.
Do you remember what your childhood understanding of environmentalism was?
You know, I don't really think I had an understanding of environmentalism. We didn't have conversations like that at my house about conserving anything. We recycled.
Yeah, we recycled. I think what I learned was through Spiral, and we had a whole segment on the rainforest. Someone came and talked to us about deforestation and the rainforest, and how I still remember this, how Mitsubishi contributed to deforestation, and we should be conservative on toilet paper. And I came home and started demanding that my family only use 2 squares of toilet paper every time they use the bathroom. And I lectured my parents about how they should never own a Mitsubishi.
Oh my God. Isn't it funny how when you're a kid, you have like these just grand ideas of, I don't know, like you have such passion for things as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I wonder, where does that passion go? You know, once you become an adult, but as a kid, you have no filter. It's much less of a filter and you get passionate about ideas. And
right. Also, you know, as kids, it's all much simpler too.
Mm-hmm.
Our experiences are narrowed down to what's immediately around us, and we can take care of the insects outside and stuff like that, but we don't understand that there's no way for us really to control other people's behaviors.
Right.
I think it's about time to step into the slow-moving time machine.
All right.
I'm actually getting pretty adept at setting these coordinates, so I set it on a timer based on approximation of how long this interview would be. So your door to the time machine should be appearing anytime about now. Let me know when you see the door on your end.
Okay. I see it. Okay. I see it. It's amazing.
I know, it's quite a wonder. I never thought that I would be able to create something that could exist in more places than one.
It's a pretty cool thing.
All right. So as a quick aside, before we hop in there, while in the time machine, we'll be talking a bit about some of the problematic content in this movie, including ethnic coding and colonialist themes. This is where I normally advise people to pause and join in after watching the movie, because there might be spoilers in the time machine. But if you want to learn about these issues before watching, keep listening and we will address them before getting into the history of the film. That being said, Dot and the Whale is available on YouTube for free. And if you are ready, Melissa, we will go through our respective doors and I will see you inside.
All right.
Here we go. So here we are. What do you think?
It's amazing.
Thank you. As you can see, our sides are separated to remain socially distanced and safe.
Uh-huh.
We are recording this in April, but by the time this airs, which will be several months from now, hopefully almost everyone will have been vaccinated, so this episode is destined to be a little dated. But for the time being, we will continue to be cautious. Melissa, do you understand where we are right now and what it does?
I do not. Would you explain it to me?
Sure. And maybe I should have warned you before we got into the time machine. Silly me. Like, I am always forgetting to do that. So, when we step into the time machine, what we're essentially doing is splitting our existences into two. You are concurrently inside the time machine as well as outside the time machine watching the movie with everybody else. So, while we're in here, we're moving slightly faster than real time so that we can have this conversation and then rejoin ourselves when we're done watching the movie. So you'll have two sets of memories that come back together at once you step out of the time machine. And it can be a little disorienting, but it only lasts for a couple minutes and then everything becomes bobulated.
Perhaps.
Okay.
Also, if at any time you feel a little motion sickness or queasy from being in the time machine, that is completely normal. And there is a water dispenser on your side in case you're thirsty.
Oh, good to know. Good to know.
Okay. So as promised, we will talk about some of the issues in the film before getting to the story of how Dot and the Whale was made. Melissa, do you know very much about race or ethnic coding in film?
I do not.
Okay, so it is the practice in movies and TV shows to depict people of color or people of non-American ethnicities as stereotypes. In this case, non-Australian. In Dot and the Whale, all of the human characters are white and all of them have Australian accents except for one, who has a caricature of an Italian accent. And this character is the main antagonist of the film. And this kind of ethnic coding of the villain being foreign or an immigrant citizen has a long history in animation, and it still continues to this day. So it's really important to be aware of it. In the United States, this kind of coding has historically leaned towards villains having a British accent, or slightly less often than that, Germanic or Russian.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of any villains with accents from cartoons from the top of your head?
The first one that popped in my head was Bullwinkle and the Boris and Natasha.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first one that popped in my head.
Yeah, very good. I had thought of that, but I didn't actually include that in my notes. So there's Scar from The Lion King.
Yeah. Which I always thought that was weird that he has an accent, but his brother doesn't and nobody else in his family does.
Exactly. Yeah. Or Jafar from Aladdin.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Prince John and Robin Hood.
Yeah.
And I know that that takes place in England. And I think Robin Hood also has a British accent, but a lot of the other characters do not.
Yeah, that's true.
In the case of Germanic or Russian accents, it's thought that this depiction is a direct holdover from World War II and the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. I could see that.
Yeah. For a little more recent example of this practice, Dr. Doofenshmirtz in Phineas and Ferb has a German accent.
Mm-hmm. That is true. Yeah.
This is so common that having one of these accents is a signal to viewers that the character is a villain before anything villainous is depicted in the story. And henchmen in animated TV and film often speak in dialects associated with low socioeconomic status, like regional American dialects or Eastern European dialects. In the case of Dot and the Whale, from what I could glean from my limited internet research, it appears that this choice to single out an Italian person as the villain is a product of a very long history of prejudice in Australia against people from Italy. Before moving on, I want to include a passage from what was a great resource on this subject, an article from The Atlantic by Isabel Fattel. Language tropes can have far-reaching consequences, both for kids' perceptions of those around them and their understandings of themselves. Research has shown that kids use TV as a key source of information about other ethnic groups, as well as about their own ethnic or racial identities. Linguists have also found that not only do people make judgments about their peers' intelligence and education levels based on language characteristics, with those who speak standard dialects usually being viewed as smarter and better looking, but also that those judgments often shape how a person or group of people is treated. These patterns imply that when children see a correlation between evil and foreignness, or between evil and low socioeconomic status, there's a good chance they are internalizing negative perceptions of themselves or other groups. Then she goes on to encourage parents to help children become media literate to enable them to identify these things while viewing cartoons. I found all this really, really fascinating.
Yeah, and it all makes sense. And I can see that for sure. In the shows that my kids watch, and they are learning in Spanish at their school, that's helping them. They have an opportunity that I didn't have as a kid. And so I think I had some of those prejudices from TV shows, from some of my family members, how they spoke about different ethnicities. And I had those prejudices, whereas my kids will maybe not have as many of those prejudices because they've been exposed to different kinds of people and in a positive light.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so important to recognize the influence that that can have over you as a child, like, and recognize the way that you were influenced and the way that you thought about things because you didn't have the context or the history, or you didn't have like a broader understanding of things. You're just kind of absorbing the information that is coming in all around you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, the second issue is regarding passing statements in the film, such as Captain Cook was the greatest explorer the world has ever known. Captain Cook was a British explorer and cartographer that was the first European to land on Australia. This led to the British colonizing of Australia and the long and brutal treatment of the Aboriginal people that had lived there long before. By making this statement within a film with the only characters being white and having this glossed over version of history further corroborated by the sea life in the film, excludes the rights and existence of the Aboriginal people, passively shaping the way non-Aboriginal viewers think or don't think about the Aboriginal people in a similar way to the race coding that we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
All this, of course, is not dissimilar from how we were taught about Thanksgiving in school when we were kids. The version of the past where colonists and Native Americans were friends and shared food with one another, and completely erasing the history of the brutal treatment of Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's That's all I have before we talk about the movie.
All right.
I think it's really important to recognize these things, especially when we're watching older media, so we can be aware of how people and history are represented or misrepresented and in present media. To talk about Dot and the Whale, the movie, we'll have to first go way, way back to 1899, when Australian author Ethel C. Pedley published a children's book called Dot and the Kangaroo. It's the story of a young girl named Dot who gets lost in the Australian bush. She meets a kangaroo who gives her berries to eat that allows her to talk to animals, and the kangaroo helps her out of the forest. I wish I had found those berries when I was little. How about you?
Right? It would have made writing Star a lot easier.
Yeah, it would. You could just figure out what the problem is.
Exactly.
The story, Dot and the Kangaroo, is unique for the time because it has major conservationist themes, well before environmentalism was a term, and the book was hugely influential in Australia. I have not read it, but I read some reviews on the book written by Australian people, and from what I can tell, people find the book interesting from a historical perspective, but the racist Aboriginal stereotypes would prevent them from sharing it with children.
Mm-hmm.
The book was adapted into a musical in 1924 and then into an animated film in 1977, which brings us to Yoram Gross, the director of Dot and the Kangaroo and eventually Dot and the Whale. In things that I found online, Yoram Gross's name is directly associated with children's and family entertainment in Australia. Yoram Gross, who was Jewish, was born in Poland in 1926 and survived Nazi persecution during World War II by moving to different hiding places 72 times.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he studied music and then film in the late 40s and began making experimental pictures. In 1967, he and his wife Sandra moved to Australia, and together they established Yoram Gross Film Studio, now known as Flying Bark Productions. For their first animated film, they were looking to produce a full-length animated movie that would have international appeal, and they landed on Dot and the Kangaroo. For Dot and the Kangaroo, Gross developed an experimental technique of drawing over a live-action background. It was a style that his animated films came to be known for, and one that you remember from Dot and the Whale.
Yep.
Dot and the Kangaroo was award-winning and a critical success and kicked off a series of 8 more Dot films throughout the 80s.
Wow, I had no idea there were that many.
I didn't either until I started researching this. But here they are. Around the World with Dot, Dot and the Bunny, Dot and the Koala, Dot and Keto, which is a mosquito, Dot and the Whale, Dot and the Smugglers, Dot Goes to Hollywood, and Dot in Space.
Does she meet aliens?
I think she goes to another planet.
That's fun.
Yeah, and most of these movies have environmentalist themes. And I just want to say that towards the end there, Dot seemed to travel quite a similar path to Jason Voorhees, for my horror friends out there. I know Jason went to Manhattan and not to Hollywood, but then they both went to space, so. I don't know if you watch horror movies, Melissa.
Not a whole lot.
Jason Voorhees is from Friday the 13th.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that series. And the last movie, I think it's the last movie, I don't know. It's Jason X and he goes to space.
Oh gosh. It's like the Land Before Time movies that they kept making them and they kept getting worse.
Yeah, exactly like that. I have no idea how many Land Before Time movies there are or if there are more or less than Friday the 13th movies.
I think there are like a dozen. And the first one was good. The second one was okay. And then the rest were just not.
I remember seeing the second one because I remember we watched it for the last day of school before Easter when I was in fifth grade for our, you know, our Easter party or whatever. But beyond that, I haven't seen any of those movies. I know they start to become musicals.
Yes, they do. I watched one with my kids. It was like numbered, I don't know, 47,000. And it was not good. I don't want to watch this with you anymore.
That's so funny. Okay, back to Dot and the Whale. Now, because Dot and the Whale, which came out in 1986, falls right in the middle of the series, there isn't a whole lot on this movie specifically. But I did find a very comprehensive review on a website called Oz Movies, and I wanted to include some bits from it because I think it's pretty insightful. But I could not find the name of the writer to credit them, so I'm sorry. I tried. It's in the language of an art critique, so Melissa, brace yourself for some technical writing.
All right.
All right. In Dot and the Whale, there are points in the film where the combination of live and animated material is composed within the frame as though it were a collage or cubist painting. The contours and planes are so demarcated that the shapes cut away their representational anchor and tend to battle for the space of the frame. In debt to the film practices of the 1920s, experimental artist Stan Vanderbeek, in some of his films of the 1950s, incorporated collages with exposed film in a similar vein and effect to that of Dot and the Whale. And like the earlier work of Lai, Vanderbeek also applied paint directly onto the film. The technique is a form of animation directly applied to the celluloid strip. It is a technique Vanderbeek called time painting, but in a gross, that's Yoram Gross, film. The frame as a whole has a sense of completeness in which the materials are in a dynamic, conflicting relationship with one another, a relationship that goes halfway into abstraction. I think it's funny that someone thought about this movie that much.
Yes, I agree. With as much time as I spent thinking about it and trying to find it, I can see why they spent so much time on it.
Right. So Don the Whale has a very positive message about taking care of the environment and taking care of animals, and also is an empowering message about kids being able to make a change on their own without adults. But because of the heavy-handed approach of talking about whaling and the practices' effect on whale populations, it can be a rather sad movie. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes. Yeah. I remember feeling very sad when I watched it.
Yeah.
Very sad.
Exactly. So you'll probably feel a little sad out there too. So before we join back together, I thought I would end with some hopeful facts. According to the International Whaling Commission, due to conservation efforts, several whale species have been increasing in population year after year and have reached healthy levels in some areas. One of the biggest successes is the humpback whale, whose population in the North Atlantic has recovered to pre-whaling levels and have shown a strong recovery in other parts of the world as well. At this point, the largest threat to whale populations is pollution, so it remains important for us to educate ourselves on how we can best prevent contributing to polluting our oceans. And that's all I have. I thought it was really nice to know that a lot of whales are getting healthier in their populations.
Yeah, that's awesome to know. That's really great.
Yeah. You know, I just kind of assumed things were just getting worse.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a lot of focus on the negative in things, but there's a lot of people out there that want to make a difference and that are making a difference just in their own community or in the world at large. You know, there's a lot of good out there, but I think the bad makes the news more often. The bad is more salacious.
Right. Yeah. So we hear about the endangered animals and not when those animals come out of being an endangered species.
Exactly. There should be like a party for animals that cross that line from being endangered to being okay and stable. There should be like a celebration.
Absolutely. I would go to those parties.
Right.
All right. Well, are you ready to rejoin yourself and get your memories combined of having seen this movie as an adult?
I believe so. I've got my water ready.
Okay, I'm going to slow it down and then we can step out of here.
All right.
All passengers must return to their respective times. Goodbye.
All right, we have arrived at the Dot and the Whale Zoom party. How are you feeling, Melissa?
It was nostalgic and weird, just like I was expecting it to be.
Have all your memories kind of aligned?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just about as odd as I remembered it.
Now we're here with everybody else. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here.
Hello.
Hello.
So I want to just go ahead and open it up to everyone to share some general thoughts before we get to the other questions. What do you think? What did you like? What didn't you like? And so on.
Like Melissa, it was very nostalgic. As we were watching it, I was like, oh, I remember this, especially the music. But there was a couple of visuals too that lasted a long time in my brain.
What was your favorite song?
I don't know. The only one that's coming to mind right now is Save the Whale. Save the Whale, but that's probably my least favorite.
That's because you don't like kids' voices singing.
Asa left during that song.
Yes. Yeah, so we had another person at the Zoom party, some friends from college, Nate and Laura, and their daughter Alice. And right when the song started, why don't they leave us alone?
That one.
They dropped out immediately.
I think that one's my favorite.
Is not liking kids' voices or kids singing a thing?
It depends. It's that airiness, like the Peanuts movies. It just gets me. I don't know. It's like nails on a chalkboard for me.
All the Christmas songs, Janie.
I want to buy these shoes for my mama, please. I know. No, just stop.
All right. So this is, I really love the comment of like, this is the part I tried to explain to my mom and she thought I was making this movie up. I'm also just imagining like the way a kid explains things. And I just like had a good laugh to myself. Kid would sound insane.
I did. I sounded insane. And it sounded like something a kid would dream up. I was like, you know, there's this girl and she's floating around in the ocean. And then she gets her foot stung by a coral. And then she floats over to this like octopus with glowing eyes and it probes her foot. Mom, do you remember this movie? She's like, no, I don't.
She's like, don't talk about this in public.
They'll take you away.
Anybody else, their thoughts or impressions about the movie?
I like how she just kind of floated. She didn't really swim. That's exactly like Melissa's definition, a girl just floating through the ocean. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like she has a figurative tail or an invisible tail that propels her through the ocean.
I'm pretty sure she was definitely dead the whole time. And then she just had a lot of unexpected, unfinished business.
Yeah. Did you notice how strange and emotional it became after she was underwater for 20 minutes?
Although if I'm anywhere for 20 minutes, it's going to be like strange and emotional, especially these days.
I wish there were more contemporary movies with this art style. I feel like it could be like reimagined. I guess there's like Fantasia that doesn't have a cohesive plot, but like this, we've watched a few movies lately on the show that have this kind of mixed media. And every time I see it done again, I am refreshed as to why I like it.
Yeah, it's like Roger Rabbit.
Love to see them do Finding Nemo like this.
So I don't know how many people were here for the whole pre-show, but there was a little clip that I inserted from Dot and the Kangaroo, which was Dot's first movie, where it shows the reason why she's able to understand animals. A kangaroo gives her magic berries that enables her to speak with animals. So like we jump straight into this movie with no context of that. And I've always wondered, I was like, this girl just magically knows how to talk to animals. So she is able to talk to animals, but then Dot is friends with Nelson, the dolphin, who teaches her how to be underwater and to dolphin think for hours without having to breathe. If you could befriend one animal and have them teach you a certain skill or characteristic, what would it be and why?
I think I would stay clear of any ocean animals because the ocean is just so scary to me.
Fair.
So I don't know, maybe like a monkey. I could swing and climb.
I'm with Chaney and like, you gotta respect the ocean. Just like leave that baby to be. But I think I would go with chipmunk, obviously. Like how do you get so much food in your mouth?
My first response is half serious and half joking. It would be a mantis shrimp, so I can absolutely perfect my 1-inch punch.
You know, mantis shrimps also can see a whole array of color that we can't.
Which, oh man, if that was a skill that I could actually learn from them, I would 100% do.
Fact check.
So I have some bad news. Mantis shrimps can't see a whole array of colors. Their brains are too small to mix the various colors. So we have 3 color receptors and we mix them in our brains. Unfortunately, mantis shrimps can't mix colors. So those color receptors are mostly 4 colors that we can already see.
I've got an animal and I think I've got a pretty good rationale for it. I think it would be good to learn from a sloth. Reason 1, slow down your metabolism so far that you don't need food for months. Reason two, to grow a garden and just always have it with you. Reason three, get smashed off bamboo, healthy.
If I could befriend an animal and learn a skill, I would befriend a human and learn how to socialize.
That's deep. Food.
I said I would stay away from the ocean, but actually I think I would want to learn from a cuttlefish because they can change their colors. They can change their patterns. They can change their texture. That's just really cool.
That would work well for you as an
actor. Where are
you
trying to escape to?
I will never tell.
Okay. I want to learn from an elephant because my memory cuts off after about a day.
That's fair.
I'm not laughing at you. It just sounded like you weren't finished. It sounded like you forgot what you were talking about.
I am an amazing actor, y'all.
I would definitely want to befriend a dog and just learn how to be so like stoked and down. Just like absolutely contented with wherever you are and excited to be with whoever you're with. On a little bit of a separate note, those berries that she ate to gain the knowledge to talk with animals, I had a friend in college who used to grow those in his dorm.
Oh, yeah?
I'd always want to be some aquatic creature. And the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to be either a skate so I could fly underwater. And then I started thinking, no, I want to be either a dolphin or a flying fish. That way, when I was flying through the water, you jump out of the water and you're in an entirely different environment. And I just think that would be so weird. It's like all of a sudden air and there's like no resistance and the acoustics are different. And then you splash back in the water and you're fine.
I like the octopus a lot because they're really smart. And they also change colors and can like fade into wherever they are. And they can like solve puzzles with their tentacles. And
yeah, they're escape masters. Did y'all hear the story about the one at the zoo?
Yes.
Yeah. They would put it in its container. And then in the next day, they wouldn't be able to find it because it crawled out. And they would have to like find it in a different aquarium and put it back because it was eating all the other fish.
Another aquarium octopus story I just heard. One of the caretakers of an octopus giving him shrimp, and apparently they gave him a couple bad shrimp. So the octopus snuck out of its cage with the bad shrimp, went over to its caretaker's desk and threw the bad shrimp on the caretaker's desk and then went back into its home.
Wow.
Screw you, caretaker. You're a dick.
I know the animal I would choose now. It took me a long time to think, but... Okay. Definitely a burrowing animal.
Ooh.
I would want probably like a mole or a possum. I could get behind being a possum.
Why would you want to be able to burrow?
I really like dirt.
That's a good answer.
You know, I was thinking about it. I have a couple of little charms in my bathroom. One of them is a wing from like a hummingbird. And then the other is a turtle, because I'm a hummingbird with decisions and with everything. I'm like, oh, let's do this. Oh, no, wait, let's do that. And I tend to make decisions in the moment. And a lot of times it doesn't work out super well. And then my husband is like a turtle. He wants to see every aspect of everything and think about it logically. And well, what about this way? And well, you know, this is another option that we could think about. And, you know, I think I need some more turtle in me to balance my hummingbird because I'm very like, oh, flitty, and I should slow down.
What ocean creature in the movie would you most want to hang out with and why?
Nelson. He can beat up anybody.
Yeah, and the ocean is a scary place.
The Oracle.
Exactly. He freaked me out. The Oracle. He freaked me out as a kid.
But
glowy eyes.
Talking about sea animals that you'd want to learn something from. You learn from your friends. I've learned from you.
Oh, okay.
Be friends with the Oracle.
And learn his tentacly ways.
I can tell you who I don't want to hang out with.
Who?
I don't want to hang out with the blowfish.
Ooh, throw in sea shade.
I don't want to hang out with him.
The one that like is super crabby when someone opens his door, but then the rest of the time wanders around in a diver's suit moaning.
It's like moaning Myrtle of the sea.
I want to hang out with the group of seahorses. I just want them to follow me around and be my little chorus.
And talk in sync with one another?
I don't know.
I think I would choose the turtle that's not very good at swimming. Like, I'm always down for the friend who's like, you know what? I don't want to do this activity, but I respect that you do. I love turtles.
You mean the tortoise that should be a sea turtle?
It's like a very good swimming tortoise.
I just love that every time he took a stroke underwater, he's like, because it's hard for him. Because he doesn't have the right feet.
He doesn't have the right shell, doesn't have the right legs, doesn't have like the right feet, probably can't breathe.
He's like a square block trying to fit into a circle hole. Like, I'm all about that. We all feel like that sometimes.
I also didn't want to hang out with the penguin.
Oh, yeah. That penguin was bad company, let me tell you. And a deadbeat dad, sounds like.
I went to go check. Nobody sees him. I went to go check.
He's there. I didn't see him, but he's there.
Oh. And he's sticking eggs up little girls' skirts. It's not okay.
Hey, that's how they keep their eggs warm.
By sticking eggs up little girls' skirts?
No. They, you know. Come on.
You actually just explain it in detail to me.
The way that penguins keep their eggs warm?
Yeah.
So the eggs can't ever touch the snow because it takes about 3 seconds before the young inside the egg will freeze to death if it touches the snow. And then the fathers have to balance the egg, and then they take their little flap of fat stomach and tuck it over the egg. So he was just using her dress like his fat stomach, you know?
How do you know this? That actually is, I just learned a lot. If that doesn't make it in the podcast, that's staying with me forever. I always just thought it was the only practical way for penguins to, like, because they don't have any legs or anything. I was like, this just seems like
they have legs
covered by their fat little stomachs.
They just have stumpy legs like me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to make some weird comment about how your legs are hidden by your stomach, but I was like, don't say that. Just don't.
You've never seen me in person. They could.
So no one said this one, but I wouldn't mind hanging out with the crab. You know, he's nervous, but he knows things. And whenever he talks, there's like old footage that plays.
It freaks me out that his claws are coming out of his mouth. I mean, I guess he's just so delicious that he can't even help himself.
It reminded me of the crab from Moana, but like way more nervous. I want them to hang out. I feel like it would be good for both of them. I feel like that crab in the Dot movie, like the way he's organizing everything, I think he's a little bit obsessive compulsive. I identify with that.
I just want to say the thing that turned me off about the crab was that he was collecting little cannonballs. So I'm like, are you just like a weapon hoarder? Like, I don't know.
He was organizing them and he had them all accounted by how many numbers of guns there were and how many cannonballs there were. And he had like all the history down.
Just because you know the history and you're well-organized does not detract from the fact that you're just, like, hoarding weapons. The crab reminded me of, like, a doomsday prepper.
I was going to say, maybe he's a doomsday prepper.
I just don't see it that way. I don't think that the, even though he knows the history, doesn't really, he sees them as objects rather than something else.
So he's just a collector?
I think he's just moving around what's already there.
He should open up a museum.
Okay, so do any of y'all have memories of when you were little? Of rescuing animals or standing up for animals?
My brother and I would rescue baby blue jays when they fell out of the nest. We didn't understand that the mom was like pushing them out of the nest so they could practice flying. And so we would rescue them and put them in like a shoebox and hang out with them until they were ready to fly. But I don't know if it was the right thing to do, but we did it. And we named them after the Rockets basketball players at the time.
My parents worked for the city of Austin, like the animal shelters. And so my parents started off fostering one cat. And then my mom, who's not from this country, realized that like, oh, this is a real problem in America. So at one point in my life, we had 16 kittens in our house, which was really cool up until we passed number like 8, I think. Yeah, we had a lot of kittens in our house and we fostered them until, you know, they were old enough to get their shots. okay, my parents were like standing up for cats and stuff like that. But then these cats started trying to like repay the favor. So they would bring in like birds for us. So we had like a billion cats and then a bunch of dead birds. And we never knew what to do with it. We just looked like a bunch of like, I'm sure our neighbors thought we were all sociopaths. Because they also saw me on the yard, like burning ants with a magnifying glass, like probably surrounded by all these dead birds. They probably thought like a seance was going on. Sorry, I cannot really answer your question, but I would say that my parents really love animals.
What's funny is that the story that I had was chasing little kids around the playground at recess and fussing at them for kicking over anthills.
Oh, I once kicked a boy in the shins because he decided to spend recess stamping on snails. I was like, that's not very nice. You're the sociopath. I just burn ants.
My only childhood memory with animals was burning ants with a magnifying glass. No kind memories.
Do you ever like upgrade from like burning ants to finding dried leaves and starting little fires?
No.
Me either.
One of my favorite things growing up was visiting New England Aquarium. In the 70s, there was a seal, Andre the Seal, who would winter at the aquarium, and then he would summer up in Port Maine.
Sounds like a very posh seal. He would winter and summer.
Oh, yes, yes, quite, yes.
My grandparents and I were driving home from our cottage. This is in Ontario, in Canada. We were passing a farm, and there was a colt that had gotten out of the gate of this horse farm. Colt is a baby horse. And he wasn't more than a few months old, but he had somehow gotten outside the fence. And his mom was freaking out. And luckily, for some reason or another, I had an extra halter in the car. And I think I used like my belt as a lead rope. And I like lassoed it around the colt's neck and we brought it home to his mom.
Oh, that's sweet.
She was happy.
I have a story. When I was a child, there was a class that I went to that had something to do with how tadpoles don't have a very good survivability rate. And so during our recess hour, one of the kids in my class decided to lead an organized protest. And we made picket signs and marched around the school chanting, "Save our tadpoles, save our tadpoles, sot, 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 sot," for like 30 minutes. That's the whole story. I'm assuming most of the tadpoles still died, but I don't know. I don't have the data.
Oh my gosh, Cullen, you made me think of another story that I had when I was in fifth grade. There was this boy that brought a big praying mantis, like it's like this big for anybody listening. It was like 4 inches long. And I don't know what I convinced him to trade me praying mantis for something, but I convinced him to do that. I was very convincing back then. And so then me and like my three friends, I also convinced them that what we were going to do was hang out with this praying mantis during recess. Every day for recess. And that if we went outside, we were going out there to catch grasshoppers to feed the praying mantis. And we would just hang out with this praying mantis and play with it. Her name was Buttercup. And eventually she died. But before she died, she laid a giant thing of eggs on the side of the jar. And the teacher was really excited about that. She was like, yes, we're going to see this happen. So then they started hatching. And we put like little drops of water, but some of them were drowning in the water on the bottom, but they didn't have anything to eat. So I thought like, what can we feed them that they'll be able to eat that's like small enough for them? So I went and brought a whole bunch of plants in that had aphids on them. And sure enough, they ate the aphids. But then like they just started dying because they had nowhere to go. I had already had many arguments with the teacher about letting the praying mantises go. So one day we had a substitute teacher come in. And while my teacher wasn't there, I took the jar of baby praying mantises home and set them free.
Woo!
Rebel, rebel, Bailey.
Wow, Bailey, I didn't know that story.
Yeah, my teacher was not happy with me, but then she couldn't really like punish me because what was she going to say? I was just like, they were dying and they needed to be free.
Your daughter stole the jar and released all of these insects so they could be free.
Bailey, do you remember, were you in choir when we cleaned out Mr. Morgan's fish tank and ended up killing all of his fish?
Oh, no, 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 no. He had one fish. His name was Oscar.
I thought it was Big Mama.
Big Mama, that's it.
Big Mama.
Big Mama, and Big Mama was an Oscar. And Big Mama died. He was really sad about Big Mama dying, so we thought we'd replace it. So we all pitched in and bought him this really fancy fish, but we wanted it to be a surprise. So someone brought in a spare fish tank, and it was like a small one. And someone else was like, well, it's really dirty. We need to clean it out. So they took it home and they cleaned it out with detergent. And so when we put the water in there and put the fish in there, the fish died from the chemicals in the water.
Yeah.
It was really sad.
And didn't we like take the blanket or something that was covering it up off and like, surprise, oh wait.
I don't remember that.
I remember that.
Oh, and by the way, Mr. Morgan was our choir director in middle school.
When he saw the fish, was it already dead, or like how did that reveal go?
I think we still thought the fish was alive. And so we were gonna like surprise him. Surprise, we got you a new fish, but we just surprised him with another dead fish.
So it was already dead the first time we saw it.
Sounds like it.
Dead the first
surprise.
Time.
That's hilarious.
Ilya, did you have a story?
Yeah, so I grew up, my mom was a vet tech before she became a teacher. And then she was an art teacher for a long time and then kind of switched into science because, you know, I guess she could also do that. But she loved animals and everyone knew that she loved animals. And I grew up with like so many animals in my house. We had like ferret, chinchilla, gerbils, fish, turtles, like rats, snakes. Dang, there's like probably a lot more iguanas, birds, like there's like all kinds of different, it was like living sort of in a small zoo. And a lot of these animals would live in her school with her. And then they'd come home in the summer. I was just known as the kid with all of the animals. And so if somebody around the neighborhood, like one of my friends found like a little like lost cat or a lost dog, or they had chickens and one of them was hurt, or like my friends had goats and like the goat was dying, I was always the person that would be like, your mom knows how to take care of animals. I'm going to give you this baby animal. I was like, that's right. We're going to rescue this baby animal. And I'd be like, Mom, I found this baby animal. I brought a lot of baby animals home to my mom to take care of. So it wasn't just her fault. It was also my fault that we had so many animals. My friends had a farm. We took this baby goat. My mom loves baby goats, but she won't ever let me get her one. So I just forcefully was like, baby goat's going to die. I brought it home. And she was like, oh, not another animal, you know? And then she falls in love with it. And she comes in my room all excited. She's like, guess what the goat's name is? I was like, what's the goat's name? She's like, he named himself. I was like, oh, yeah, Mom? She's like, his name's Earl. And I was like, you love this goat, Mom. And then she knitted it little horn tassels and like a whole halter and then took him to the fucking Ren Fair with her all the time. And I was like, you love Earl. And he's like the Duke of Earl or something. Like that. And like, just like how much she didn't want these animals, she loved them a lot.
That's so cute.
I remember we used to take care of that gardener snake that was in grandma's yard that Charlie picked up, our cousin picked up, and accidentally impaled it with her nail. So it had a scar on its stomach. So we always knew when we would find him because he had that scar on his tummy.
Yeah, his name was JJ. And I think taking care was more like we lifted a stone and tore him from his home and put him in a box for a little while we were at our grandma's house until we were going to leave. And then we put him back where we found him.
Super helpful.
We pet him. We showed him love. That's taking care of him in children's views.
Yeah. And let's all remember, everybody's love language is different.
Some people like to kidnap you and put you in a box. And that's just their way of saying, I love you and I'm taking care of you.
I got to say that I really like the whole dot thing. For all its wonderful message. And just like, couldn't they have just made a little better effort to get the oceanography right? But I loved its simplicity. I thought it was charming. I got a sense of nostalgia, and I never had seen it before.
I do agree with that. I felt like for a movie that ultimately felt like it was trying to send a message, it didn't talk about marine biologists, as we all noted. It didn't talk about any actual legitimate efforts that were going on in regards to conservation ocean efforts. And then they put a tortoise in the ocean. That bothered me so much.
The takeaway that I got from this movie is that if we continue to ignore these issues, the kids are just going to have to keep dealing with them.
Adults don't listen, and they take too long to do shit.
Melissa, thank you so much for sharing this movie with us.
Sure. It was a fantastic memory, and it lived up to all of the memories and nostalgia that I had.
Do you have any final thoughts before we end this?
Well, I'm glad that you guys watched it. It's nice to have other people know that it's a real movie.
Yeah, you're not alone.
I'm not alone, and I was never crazy.
Yeah, Mom.
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 Yeah.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming and sharing your stories. This has been Memory Static. Return your videos here.
Return your videos here.
We'd like to dedicate this track to all the marine animals and their habitats and the ongoing human effort to correct the ongoing human damage. We hope that it will inspire you to join our cause.
This plastic in the ocean, what are we gonna do about that? We've gotta get all the plastic out of the ocean for the sea turtles, the dolphins, and all that. Yes, we know. We just rhyme that with that.
Well, so go online to SaveTheWhales.org. Go to the OceanCleanup.com. OceanBlueProject.org is also an option. Join the movement at seasave.org.
That's spelled S-E-A, not S-E-E.
This may sound like a silly song, but the problem is actually quite serious. We know it may sound like we're not serious, but we are, and that's why we wrote this song.
And if you want, you can sing along to this song.
There's a shit ton of plastic. gotta get all those microplastics out of the ocean.
Thank you for listening to Memory Static. This episode was produced and edited by me, Bailey Moore. Additional sound editing by Cullen Moore. The Ridiculous Song is by me and Cullen Moore. All of the nonprofits mentioned in the song are real, and if you have some money to spare for donations, please consider donating to one of these ocean conservation and cleanup nonprofits. If you have any stories to share about anything covered in this episode or any Memory Static episode, write to me at memorystatic@gmail.com. I'd love to hear your stories. If you live in the Austin area and want to come to one of our screenings, follow us on Facebook and Instagram. That's it. See you next month.